This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and our guest is Susan Orlean, and she has written the award-winning book for the best book produced for writing in the arts from 2018. And this award is given by the D.C. Arts Club of Washington, and it is a coveted award. It's very competitive. Her book has championed above those in photography, dance, architecture, and every other field in the arts. Welcome to Washington. We love you.
Thank you so much. I'm really happy to be here.
It is a great thing to have an award for writing in the arts. And when you were writing this book, did you know you were writing a book that was writing in the arts?
No, although looking back on it now, I realize that I obviously think writing about writing, which is really what my book is about.
That's right.
Is certainly writing about the arts and writing about the idea of what the arts do, which is to express who we are as a civilization.
It's a beautiful book. It's great reading. It's delicious. And I would like you to tell the audience what it's about.
Well, my book is called The Library Book. It is about several things all at once, but the primary narrative engine is it's about the largest library fire in the history of the United States. And this was the burning of the Central Library in Los Angeles in 1986, which destroyed 400,000 books and damaged 700,000 more. So the book is about that fire, about the investigation into the fire, and incidentally, about the meaning of libraries in our lives, the history of this particular library, but also the present and future of libraries.
Susan Orlean, and the book is called The Library Book, the award-winning Marfield Prize for the best book writing in the arts. When you were little, or when was it that you discovered that detail was everything in writing? At what time in your life did you know that that detail is what was going to make you famous?
When I fell in love with reading, which was when I was a very young child, what transported me, what really made the writing come alive were the specifics, the exact detail, the color of someone's eye, the sound of someone's voice, those bits of texture that made these words on a page, these little marks of ink on paper, feel like you were being transported into another world.
I can just see you walking down the street. I was walking in front of you at the Library of Congress, and I thought, oh, she's going to say, a short person with dark hair was bobbing along, because you notice everything. What a gift. And that is what makes this delicious. Page after page, the blue hair of the librarian, every facial expression.
And thank you.
Another thing, the plot of the book, as you said, centers around the arson, the fire, and the books that were destroyed in the history of libraries. The character that was considered the arsonist, Harry Peake, tell us more about that.
Harry Peake was a young man who had moved to Los Angeles from the outskirts of the city when he had finished high school with great dreams and ambitions. Like many, many people who come to Los Angeles, he dreamed of being a star. I say that he dreamed of being a star rather than dreaming of being an actor, because I think really what attracted him was the narcotic appeal of celebrity.
But he's so annoying. I mean, even though they say he was charming, his irresponsibility really made me crazy.
Oh, yeah.
But here's the thing, what was brilliant about the structure of this book. You let us know who the arsonist is early on. And then the reader knows everything the characters in the book don't know. So you pull that thread through. How did you arrive at that structure, which is almost like a mystery novel?
It was very challenging because I was also trying to thread through it the story of the library's history, as well as the story of the library today. This is a place that recovered from this calamity and has gone on to thrive. And answering the question of what the meaning of libraries is today was a very important part of the book. So I was really confronted with the equivalent of four different storylines that I wanted to give equal weight. And normally in a book, particularly the books I've written, there's one primary narrative that's the most important narrative, and everything else is sort of serving that narrative. In this case, these individual narratives were all equally important.
How did you do that? And I mean, I'm old enough that we used to use index cards.
Well, I use index cards.
And put them up on the wall?
Yes.
Oh, thank you.
I have to say, there has never been an improvement on the 5x8 index card.
I feel so with it. I'm so with it. Susan Orlean is here with the award-winning book, and she's going to read a little bit about it. But before she does, this Harry Peake, you wrote the book, he was served time. I had the feeling you were still baffled by this and not entirely sure ever, as anyone was, of his guilt. And that helps the mystery. It's another kind of layer to the book that we leave with that one thing undone. Do you still feel that way?
I do. And I had thought that I would reach a conclusion.
I did too. We kept waiting.
Yeah, and I thought, well, I've done so much research. Surely this will ultimately lead me to a concrete decision. He did it, he didn't do it. And at the end, I was as ambivalent as I was at the beginning. And it was, on one hand, somewhat frustrating. I thought, shouldn't I come to a conclusion? On the other hand, I thought, but that is the nature of life.
And that is the humanity that is in the book, that you're in the landscape, and we feel that just that is one more so human touch that you didn't tie a knot in that. But let us hear a little piece of the book, please.
Well, I'm going to read from the beginning of the book, which is about my memories as a child. I grew up in libraries, or at least it feels that way. I was raised in the suburbs of Cleveland, just a few blocks from the brick-faced Bertram Woods branch of the Shaker Heights Public Library system. Throughout my childhood, starting when I was very young, I went there several times a week with my mother. On those visits, my mother and I walked in together, but as soon as we passed through the door, we split up and each headed to our favorite section. The library might have been the first place I was ever given autonomy. Even when I was maybe 4 or 5 years old, I was allowed to head off on my own. Then, after a while, my mother and I reunited at the checkout counter with our finds. Together, we waited as the librarian at the counter pulled out the date card and stamped it with the checkout machine, that giant fist thumping the card with a loud chunk-chunk, printing a crooked due date underneath a score of previous crooked due dates that belonged to other people, other times. Our visits to the library were never long enough for me. The place was so bountiful. I love wandering around the bookshelves, scanning the spines until something happened to catch my eye. Those visits were dreamy, frictionless interludes that promised I would leave richer than I arrived.
Susan Orlean, this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I am Grace Cavalieri. She is the well-known author of The Orchid Thief. I bring that up first because all of my friends have read that, of course. And it was adapted to a movie, which we all saw, and I think you helped with the adaptation.
I did not.
Oh, did you not?
I consulted with them, I take no credit for the writing
of it. But did you like it?
I loved it.
Oh, good.
Yeah,
okay.
I think it's really one of the great movies ever made
writing. And also, and you didn't go the way of Faulkner and Hemingway in Hollywood, and you didn't get boozed up and ruined.
Right. No.
And she is the author of 7 books, and one of them was Rin Tin Tin, another is Saturday Night. I hear that you just won, you had a doctorate, an honorary doctorate.
Right. I was given an honorary doctorate from the University of Michigan.
When was that?
That was just a couple of years ago.
Okay. And it's easier than going all through it, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. I highly recommend it as opposed to actually working on your PhD. But it was a wonderful honor.
And did you give a speech?
I did. I was honored to give the commencement address to the College of Literature, Science, and the Arts, and then gave another talk to the people who were graduating with their master's in English.
Did you get to keep the hat?
Oh, yes, of course. I got the hat and the
mantle.
Sash that is the PhD sash that you wear.
And
Yeah, it was wonderful.
Well deserved. I would like to talk about the look of the book, which I think is very clever. Would you describe it? Please, the front and also the back cover?
Yes, well, it's a very special book. For one thing, it's special for what it doesn't have, and that is it doesn't have a dust jacket. We have just the cover of the book and no dust jacket. It is a kind of textured cover, and there's also no image on the front cover. It's just the name of the book, the library book, and my name.
And an imprimatur, is that a fake book club?
No. That's
Reese's
real.
Reese's book club? Is it a real book club?
Yeah, Reese Witherspoon chose it for her book club.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I'm glad we brought that up.
Yes, so that was a wonderful.
Oh, did you meet her?
I have met her,
oh,
yeah.
I see, because you live in L.A.
Yeah.
And the back cover.
Well, we had a lot of fun with this, which is in the inside back cover, we have a trompe l'oeil of a checkout card with the old-fashioned little pocket that checkout cards used to be in.
And your son's name is the last one in it.
And yes.
What does he feel about that?
I showed it to him expecting him to be amazed, and he just shrugged it off.
Couldn't care less.
He's a teenager, so.
He couldn't care less.
Yes.
And one thing, I thought it was so venturesome. In between each chapter, there is a list of existing library books that are hilarious. When we see what people have written, the titles of those books, did you choose those titles?
Oh, yes. And I tried to choose books that in one fashion or another had some foreshadowing for what the chapter was going to be about.
I know, but they were so weird.
I know. Well,
name
that
a
was,
couple. Just I, name one.
Let's see. There's Madam Chiang Kai-shek, China's Eternal First Lady.
That was one of the more normal ones.
That's, yes. Grandma on the Internet by Natalia Shulyaeva. I'm sorry, I don't know how to pronounce it. Criteria for a Recommended Standard Occupational Exposure to Hot Environments.
Well, you know, have you read any of those books?
No.
I read one of them. I was so happy to see it pop up. One of them was Eleanor Flexner's History of the Suffragette Movement, 1968.
Oh.
And she's the Mary Wollstonecraft scholar,
uh-huh,
who's my girl. And so I had read that. I thought, oh, wow, I know something.
Yeah, but they're all real books.
They are real books, but they are hilarious.
That, yeah, The Humorous Side of Trucking, How to Rehabilitate Abandoned Buildings. They're part of what I wanted to do was give people a sense of the incredible breadth of the published word.
And you did.
You know, the idea that there, whatever you can think of, there's a book about it.
You have accomplished that more than anything else you could have done, because we saw how broad it is and how everyone has something to say and publish it. May we hear a little bit more from your book?
Yes, I'm going to read to you a short section about the fire at the Los Angeles Public Library, which was the narrative arc of the book. At first, the smoke in the fiction stacks was as pale as onion skin. Then it deepened to dove gray. Then it turned black. It wound around fiction A through L, curling in lazy ringlets. It gathered into soft puffs that bobbed and banked against the shelves like bumper cars. Suddenly, sharp fingers of flame shot through the smoke and jabbed upward. More flames erupted. The heat built. The temperature reached 451 degrees and the books began smoldering. Their covers burst like popcorn. Pages flared and blackened and then sprang away from their bindings, a ream of sooty scraps soaring on the updraft. The fire flashed through fiction, consuming as it traveled. It reached for the cookbooks. The cookbooks roasted. The fire scrambled to the sixth tier and then to the seventh. Every book in its path bloomed with flame.
This is unimaginable, isn't it?
It's quite horrible, and it's interesting to talk about it here at the Library of Congress, which also burned back in, my history will fail me right now, but it was burned.
1848?
Is that right?
No, I just made that up. You're right. That is the horror of every one that a book would burn, one book would burn. And then you tried to burn a book.
I did. As I was writing the book, I realized I had never seen a book burn. And I was curious, for the sake of being able to describe what it looked like, to burn one. But I was also very interested in the discomfort that I felt in doing it.
I don't even write in the margins, much less burn a book.
There is a feeling that we have that a book is a sort of sacred object. And the burning of books has been used throughout history as a way to repress and terrorize people. And I was curious about exploring the emotion behind it and trying to understand, is it truly this taboo that you can't burn a book? You know, I've burned newspapers. I use newspapers all the time to start fires in my fireplace. I've burned, you know, it's not about fire. It's about the book, and it's about the idea of destroying a book and the profound pain that it brings us, which to me was an inverse of the understanding of how connected we feel to books.
And that was important, that small notation in the book about what you did, because it made you so accessible to us. It put you in the middle of the landscape, and it showed us the writer writing. It showed us what the process is. What do you go through to get the feeling and the sentience that you found? And it is full of very sensual writing. I read that you were inspired to write by taking your son to the LA Central for an assignment.
Right. My son was in first grade, and he had an assignment to interview someone who worked for the city. I assumed, and I suggested to him, that he would want to interview a garbage man. He instead told me he wanted to interview a librarian, and I was very impressed with my parenting ability. I thought, I've obviously impressed this child properly. So we headed off. We were new to LA. We had just arrived a few weeks before that, and he was starting school. And we had never been to the library in LA, so we drove over to the branch that was nearest to our house, and it was such a familiar experience. It reminded me so vividly of all of those, must have been hundreds of trips that I took with my mother to the library as a child, and it was such a wonderful, nostalgic, emotional recall that I felt like I want to explore this. I want to understand why this particular trip with my mother meant so much to me.
This shows up.
Yeah.
That shows up in the book. It does. But it is not only a book about reading and books. It is not only about librarians and the history of libraries. And actually, you really take us lockstep through every librarian at the LA Central and the architecture and the funders and the firemen. But it is about America. It's about every stripe of humankind that comes in a library. It's a prism. That is what this book is about. It's about America, every single kind of person.
And that, of course, is the miracle of libraries, that they are among the few places that are public, that welcome everyone, that are available to everyone.
Even the homeless. You do quite a bit of, you give a lot of space for the homeless and how they're treated with great dignity.
And it's something that is a huge challenge for libraries, and they've risen to it in a way that is, I think, deserving of great praise.
And you were deputized at helping funnel the homeless people through one day, and you met a man with a nice suit and a beautiful broadcast voice, and tell us what you did.
Well, I thought, I'm going to see if I can get him some work as a voiceover artist. And he really had a remarkable voice. He was homeless. He was living in his car. And it struck me that he was one lucky break away from having his whole life change. So it was an impulse that I don't even think it was an unlikely one, that he had a great talent. He has a beautiful, beautiful voice. And with the right connection, he could have been somebody who would be doing the voiceover on a commercial you might be hearing.
And Susan Orlean being a great noticer, of course.
Well, I actually recorded him speaking and sent this recording to a few people I knew who hired people to do voiceover. And I suppose it's not unimaginable to report that nothing happened.
Yet.
That nothing happened yet.
Maybe
just someday.
Fall upon that. But I think that it's extraordinary. So like you, it says so much. And those things in the book enrich it. They deepen it. Your ability to capture characters, the way they talk, it's a little bit of cunning in it. It's not always so loving. It's just a little, the characters who were Harry Peake's family, when you went to visit them in their prefab home and describe them, that is the high moment in your book for me. And did they read the book, do you think?
I tried to get in touch with them, and
why did they receive you anyway? I mean, why would they want to talk about it?
Well, I think there's a very good reason, which is that they wanted, like all of us, they wanted their story to be heard. They believed that Harry had been done wrong in the court of public opinion, that their story had never been told. And I came to them saying, I just want to hear what you have to say.
Did you say, I'm writing a book?
Oh, yes. I mean, mm-hmm. They knew I was writing a book, and they knew I was writing about the fire. It was not that I promised that I would exonerate him or in any way change public opinion. But my goal was to try to tell the story as fairly as I could. And their version of it was very different from the version that the fire department
had.
That
was the place I thought this could be a movie.
Yeah.
That was the place I thought this could be the movie. This is where the movie starts.
Yeah.
Because they were something else.
And they, like Harry, were great storytellers. You know, Harry's great strength and weakness is that he had an incredible imagination, and his imagination usually applied to himself.
We could call it psychopathic.
He was definitely a compulsive liar. But he was a compulsive storyteller. Everything was a story. Every description that he ever made of his life, of how he spent his time, it was all embellished and dramatize.
That brings me to realize that for years, people thought he had done it, the fire inspectors for sure. But he had a different alibi every time he was interrogated. That had to be so frustrating. He changed his story 100 times, and yet that was not enough.
He would change it again.
I know.
And change it again.
And yet that was not enough to convict him, finally.
Well, coming up with a million alibis is not illegal. It's foolish, but it's not illegal. Mm-hmm. And the problem that made the conviction so difficult was, like many arsons, there was no hard evidence. There was nothing physical to connect him to the fire.
They admit that you really can't tell from all that detritus.
When you think of
where it started. Yeah, they might have seen where the smoke began, but there's really no way to know if a match went in a wastebasket.
I mean, the thing with arson that's very interesting is it's the least successfully prosecuted felony in this country. It is such a difficult crime to find evidence of that can stand up in court.
But that was the search is what the book is about. Will you read us a little bit more?
I'm going to read to you from the end of the book. I went to the library late one day, just before closing time, when the light outside was already dusky and the place was sleepy and slow. The library is so big that when the crowds thin out, it can feel very private, almost like a secret place. And the space is so enveloping that you have no sense of the world outside. I went down to the history department, and then I roamed from department to department, just strolling through, and crossed the beautiful hollow rotunda, a gorgeous surprise every time I entered it, and then went up the wide lap of the back staircase, where the Statue of Civilization stared at me as I made my way. The silence was more soothing than solemn. A library is a good place to soften solitude, a place where you feel part of a conversation that has gone on for hundreds and hundreds of years, even when you're all alone. The library is a whispering post. You don't need to take a book off a shelf to know there is a voice inside that is waiting to speak to you. Mm. And behind that was someone who truly believed that if he or she spoke, someone would listen.
That is Susan Orlean.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me on.
This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Reva and David Logan Foundation with support from the Sinipet Fund. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.